We talk about mental health more easily in our country these days. Over an increasing number of segments about mental health on The Exchange, it has become clear that society is catching up, giving mental illness more attention and at least intention for more treatment, putting mental health concerns up there with physical health. But it's not a level field from place to place or across American society. We focus on Asian Americans in this hour with a guidebook in hand. Jenny T. Wang is the author of Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. Jenny Wang is a clinical psychologist and Taiwanese American. During the pandemic, she offered workshops on navigating anti-Asian harassment and racial trauma. Dr. Wang is also the creator of the Instagram account Asians at Asians for Mental Health. Jenny Wang, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure. Start with the workshops on navigating anti-Asian harassment and racial trauma. There must have been a lot of demand for them. Is there still?
Yes. I would say that our community has really been trying to process what has been happening across the United States and honestly around the world for the past several years. And so, you know, there's so much of conversations about race that often didn't happen when we were growing up as children of immigrants within Asian families. I think we didn't have the language, we didn't have the knowledge about structural racism, and it was never something discussed openly. And so with the rise of the visible violence that we're seeing on social media and on TV, many of us in some ways were either re-traumatized or traumatized vicariously through watching some of the footage. And so I think the need to put language around, the need to process these encounters became even more amplifying.
You write of a journey that you took that resulted in this book. I mean, was it triggered in part by the things that were happening during the pandemic, the kinds of things we're talking about?
Absolutely. You know, as a mental health professional, I'm not, outside of the realm of being impacted in terms of my mental health as well. And so through my Instagram community, you know, I started sharing just kind of real-time processing of the Atlanta shooting and massacre of the Asian women in the spa and the different spas, and also just really processing kind of a lot of what was happening to Asian elders in particular. That was very, very alarming and heartbreaking, especially in a community and culture that highly, highly reveres and honors the older generation. And so I think for myself, it was a journey that I had to process through, and also in reading the comments and the conversations prompted by some of the posts that I shared during that time, it really highlighted a need for us to almost have a way to scaffold our own mental health as well as our own racial identity development.
Well, and in terms of what you begin with, I mean, it sounds like there's not much of a scaffold there to start with the way you describe it. There's significant, it sounds like, cultural taboos about discussing mental illness in Asian American communities.
Absolutely. You know, I think the scaffolding is almost not quite there yet for us, because in a culture that highly prioritizes values of saving face, which is this idea that, you know, we want to project the best outward image or reputation of ourselves because that also reflects upon our families and communities. That is something where, you know, it really makes it difficult to express vulnerability, to express failure, to express mental health difficulties. And so really this book, I hope, is almost just the beginning for Asian Americans, children of immigrants, to just acknowledge that they're struggling, to just acknowledge that there might be something amiss in their lives, and that perhaps we need to move towards understanding that better.
That which remains unspoken remains a problem for a lot longer, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You describe a long period of unlearning and transformation in the book. Unlearning what in particular?
You know, I think I'm always very cautious when I think about the word unlearning, because I absolutely love my Asian heritage and my culture, and so I'm not necessarily saying that it is an unlearning of these cultural facets that make us who we are. I'm actually framing it as an unlearning of a sense of perhaps rigidity with which we may apply some of these cultural frameworks. And I think being children of immigrants and being Asian American, we are growing up and living in a bicultural or multicultural space where we are simultaneously learning and experiencing kind of more Western ideas and cultural values while also retaining our Asian cultural values and heritage. And so I think one of the things I kind of help, I hope to challenge readers in this book is to say, can I live with more flexibility? Can I draw from facets of my Asian identity and my American identity to build and scaffold for the life that I want to live? And so the unlearning sometimes is just simply saying, can I question things like hierarchy, where, you know, in Asian culture, there is a very strong hierarchy, and it's not necessarily where we may, want to, I guess, in a sense, throw out the hierarchy, because in Asian culture, that hierarchy is a way that we show respect. But on the other side is, when an elder or somebody above us in that hierarchy does harm to us, do we kind of swallow that? Do we, you know, silence ourselves? And so I'm kind of helping people question that hierarchy structure and say, can we actually live with more adaptability within that? And that might be an example of an unlearning.
We're getting close to a break. You're going to hear the music in a couple of seconds here. Just curious about the, you know, some things obviously that all Asian Americans might identify with. How do you address different groups within Asian America?
Absolutely. There are, over 40 ethnic groups that are categorized within the term Asian American here in the United States. And so I am very intentional in the beginning introduction of the book to kind of name that this book was written out of my own experiences, being an East Asian woman with my own identities, marginalities, and privilege. And so, you know, within kind of our culture, there are certain themes, though, in terms of our experiences with racism, our experience of othering, the potential shared migration experiences that may have been very difficult, or a sign of hope, right, an act of hope. And so there are certain kind of themes that run throughout immigrant kind of communities, not just in Asian culture, but beyond. Mm-hmm. But I also want to fully recognize that there are certain ethnic and cultural nuances that I can't speak to.
Jenny Wang with permission to come home, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, we're talking to psychologist Jenny T. Wang, also Taiwanese-American, and during the pandemic, she offered workshops on navigating anti-Asian harassment and racial trauma, and took a bit of a journey herself in thinking about not just the things that were being presented from outside, but also the ways in which inside Asian-American communities mental health was being dealt with, and ended up making some changes in her own life and showing a pathway for others to follow. That's in her book, Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. You're welcome to join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So it's not just that the book is called Permission to Come Home. The chapters are Permission to Question, Permission to Feel, Permission to Rage, and there's 10 different permissions in here. Explain the phrasing you're using here, Jenny.
So I think within Asian culture, sometimes it may feel as though we are seeking permission because of kind of the hierarchy we discussed earlier between kind of parent and child, or community and individual. And so I think one of the things I wanted to challenge a little bit, even in just the chapter headings, was this idea that perhaps we could begin to claim permission over these different spaces in our life. You know, and I think part of the idea is hoping that we will be able to identify what our needs are in these spaces while holding them in tandem with the expectations of others, the pressures that we might feel from society. And so the goal is to invite us to kind of exercise a little bit more agency in these spaces and realize that we have opportunities to choose in alignment with the values that we want to live.
So back to the previous discussion about hierarchy, you're not trying to dissolve the glue that holds communities together, but you're certainly questioning the elasticity of it, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think hierarchy, you know, is steeped in all aspects of our lives, whether it's gender hierarchy, racial hierarchy, even power and privilege. And so that is one of those areas that we need to contend with, though, because when we're steeped in hierarchy, there are almost these implicit rules of where you can go, spaces you can enter, how high you can reach and dream for yourself. And so I invite people to question that hierarchy more so to invite them into perhaps seeing more or beyond what their current scope is, which then invites us to act and behave in ways that may be outside of our comfort zones, but maybe move us closer to the lives we want to live.
Well, yeah, that first title is called Permission to Question, and I did find myself smiling at your invitation to question everything. I mean, this is about really reconsidering all the things that you have considered boundaries around you in your life.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right, so come back to your own story here. Give a sense of the general feeling of fear your parents must have felt as new immigrants.
Yeah, so they came here, when I was 2 years old, and they came with no family structure here in place. They came as the only siblings of their families to immigrate to Taiwan or to the United States. And so part of it was just the sense of, we're in this new country. At the time, my mother didn't really speak any English, and so she described feeling terrified of even answering the phone because she knew that she couldn't continue the conversation beyond a hello. And so that kind of creates a sense of lack of safety for a lot of early immigrants. And for them, you know, counteracting that fear was building some sort of stability. And for many immigrants, that stability might have localized in perhaps financial stability. You know, one of the things that I remember my parents really kind of valuing was the idea of being able to own a home, that felt like a very material goal that almost drove a lot of their decision-making in our early years here in the United States. And so even this idea of safety and a structure of a home that was yours, that was building that psychological safety that I think a lot of immigrants are struggling to achieve when they first arrive here.
Well, and you point out that be safe, stay safe was drilled into you pretty hard as a kid. And it sounds like survival mode was the default. I mean, how much room in that mode for actually living?
Honestly, probably not very much. You know, when you are in survival, when you feel threatened or scared, that shuts down the mind's ability to be innovative, to be creative, right, to explore, and to even play. And so many, you know, immigrants from our parents' generation or earlier, their goal was very restricted to certain kind of value sets. And I think that scarcity mentality, right, the fear that we will never have enough or we will never feel safe enough, really restricted what they even believed was possible for the next generation, which is why I think a lot of our parents prioritized certain careers that were more viewed as more stable or, more lucrative in order to give their children a better chance going forward.
So Jenny Wang is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. It sounds like you've structured a home life with your partner and children very differently from the one you grew up in. For example, when we get into the hierarchy part again, how differently do your son and daughter relate to you versus you to your parents?
It is amazingly different. They have no problems challenging us, questioning us, negotiating with us, which were all concepts that I think I never would have conceived of as a child within kind of my parent-child dynamics. And it wasn't necessarily that I feared my parents, although there are some, you know, parent-child dynamics that look that way, but it was more so it felt disrespectful to challenge my parents. It felt dishonoring or even ungrateful to question them because I knew they were working so hard to provide a life for our family. And so now my partner and I, you know, we fully appreciate what our parents went through, but I think that we now see what they went through as a gift that allows us to engage with our children in really different ways. And they are invited to question, even though it's harder as a parent when your children question you and challenge you. But I think that that builds the development of skills that will serve them when they're adults and they need to question and challenge their workplaces, their relationships, to really live empowered lives.
It sounds like you're learning some things from them as well as them learning from you.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole chapter on permission to play was really steeped in my observations of my own kids playing so freely without restriction, without limitation. And I think being a child of immigrants, I always thought and framed play as something that was wasteful, was useless. And it wasn't until I had children of my own that I realized that play was the birthplace of innovation, creativity, and connection.
Well, it expressed itself in interesting ways, as you point out, in your life growing up. I mean, this idea of, like, you know, keep on task, you know, keep working, get mm-hmm. good grades, blend in, assimilate, don't draw attention. Why do you say it took you 38 years to say thank you after a compliment?
Well, you know, in certain kind of Asian cultures, this idea of bragging is highly kind of discouraged. And so even this idea of receiving a compliment sometimes was framed or felt like it was boastful or bragging. And I think that, you know, there's also this element of, you know, I remember my parents telling me, succeed, but don't stick out. Do well, but don't do so well that you become so visible. Because that visibility might actually bring animosity, jealousy, or retaliation. And I think that frame came out of being immigrants where, you know, there was a society that sometimes judged them, that did not value them, in fact, that discriminated against them. And so visibility, whether it was good or negative visibility, was always discouraged.
So on that front of not being visible, you know, blending in, assimilating. I mean, one of the ways in which you are most likely to not blend in is to have a problem with your emotional and mental health. And so admitting that, A, that you had emotions, and B, that you needed help with them, it sounds like it was really rare.
Absolutely. And I think the stigma surrounding the mental health, right? Because I think sometimes in, you know, certain cultures, mental health is seen as something that's very severe, you know, diagnosable conditions, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, things in which, you know, you watch in the movies and people are institutionalized or hospitalized. That was the threshold for mental health. And so this idea that actually human beings have mental health themes that impact them every single minute of their day, that was not within the possibility or framing of how we discuss mental health within our culture. And so this idea of being visible and saying out loud that I struggle with perhaps depression or anxiety, that puts you out there in a way that sometimes felt like we could either be a burden to our family by admitting our mental health struggles, or that we would dishonor them or bring shame upon our family.
Jenny T. Wang is a psychologist in the Houston area, Taiwanese American, and the author of the book Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. It's a story of her own journey and an invitation for people to follow her along that path as well. You can join our conversation on The Exchange, whether you're Asian American or not, at 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. To follow up on the kind of constraints on admitting problems in your family and in your culture growing up, you have some more personal stories in here. Your mother was apparently quite emotional, but up to a point. Talk mm-hmm. about her situation with swallowing emotions.
Mm. Well, there's this term in Mandarin Chinese called si ku, and it's almost this idea of swallowing our bitterness. And I think that, you know, in Asian culture, there is a priority placed on what is kind of framed as emotional stoicism, kind of the ability to feel perhaps intensely, but not necessarily show it in an expressive way outwardly. And that was seen as a strength. People who could keep their emotions under control, almost in a constricted sort of way, were seen as having good kind of emotional skills. And that's interesting because here in American culture and in mental health fields, we're all about, you know, people being able to express emotion and to do it in ways that help promote well-being. And so even within, you know, my family structure, there was a very distinct difference where, you know, my mother was more emotionally expressive, but she didn't necessarily understand that her emotions were actually useful. So the expression of emotion would occur, but then it would get brushed aside. There wasn't a return to that emotionality to be curious about it and to understand why that emotion occurred. And then, you know, then my father was more of the stoic. And so I rarely saw emotion unless he was very, very upset. And so I kind of lived between these spaces where, on the one hand, we weren't taught to show emotions or to talk about it. And on the other hand, I would see it visibly and not know how to harness that emotional knowledge.
So let's talk about the now. How do you perceive the expression of negative emotions now? How do you just do it differently from what you were like as a child growing up in that household?
Now I think I've learned that emotions are neither good nor bad. And I think that frees us from trying to inhibit or suppress emotion, right? If emotions are no longer bad, then we're allowed to encounter them, we're allowed to approach them, we're even allowed to express them, in ways that allow us to really understand that emotion. And I always say that emotions are vital for survival. They stuck around as part of human experience because they help us direct the focus of our attention. They tell us there are certain things in our lives that we might need to investigate further. And it also helps us in many ways to mobilize, to organize for change, or to act in our lives. And so when we can frame emotions from that perspective, that they actually just provide data, that allows us to say, oh, well, what is the data trying to tell us? And sometimes, right, those emotions may arise and we do nothing, and that's okay. But we can still encounter them with curiosity and exploration. And other times, the emotion arises and it prompts us to perhaps quit a job that is toxic, or perhaps have a hard conversation with somebody because they keep harming us within that relationship. And that's what emotions give us access to. But if we block all our emotions, we don't just block the negative emotion. We actually constrict our access to positive emotions like joy, like connection, like love. And so that's the cost that we must bear if we decide to live kind of blinded to our emotional lives.
It's a real value in saying to yourself, what am I feeling? And more importantly, why am I feeling it?
Yes. Absolutely.
You touched on it briefly about the American way of people letting it all hang out. And I did start thinking about the broader culture at this point in the book and was thinking about that very point. We do seem to celebrate rage a lot at this moment in history, but otherwise there's sort of an oscillation, isn't there, between let it all hang out or don't share?
Yes. And I think this idea of inhibiting emotion is not just a Asian cultural trait. You know, that's not, I think humans in general are mm-hmm. socialized to be appropriate or be professional, right? And I think especially in the workplace, you know, when someone's raging, that's not always seen as a positive thing. And so this idea of controlling our emotions or just moderating our emotions is something that we're taught even in grade school. You know, when kids are upset or rowdy, we might say, oh, you know, don't cry, stop crying. Or we might say, hey, you're not allowed to be angry here. You're not allowed to be upset. And so we socialize children all the way into adulthood to not really go there, to not really acknowledge that those emotions have value in our lives. And I do believe that, you know, people in the mental health space, in the education space, even in the corporate leadership space, we're realizing that emotions are not harmful and that vulnerability actually builds connections between people. And so I think that's changing, but I think we have a long way to go.
And it seems like the way to go is with increasing our emotional literacy, which is an interesting term. How do you define and what are some of the components of it?
Yes. So emotional literacy, in a way, is just our ability to almost decode the experience of emotion and what that emotion is trying to kind of tell us. You know, there are some people who even struggle just to tap into what emotional state they're in because they've never learned the language, the words, or even the one-to-one connection between a physiologic and emotional experience and kind of the words attached to it. And so that emotional literacy, you know, ideally begins at a very young age. You know, when you have a child or an infant and they are angry and the parent says to them, oh, I notice that you seem very frustrated right now. You seem very angry. What we're doing in that act is teaching emotional literacy. We're giving our children the words to wrap around that emotional experience. But if we grow up without that lack of emotional kind of language or attunement, then we don't have those stepping stones to then build upon that knowledge when we're adults. And so that emotional literacy kind of forms the foundation then for emotional kind of regulation, emotional attunement, and even just emotional intelligence, which is so important in our relational and work lives.
We will come back and talk more with Dr. Jenny Wang, a psychologist in clinical practice in Houston, Taiwanese American, the author of the book Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. Dr. Wang offered workshops during the pandemic on navigating anti-Asian harassment and racial trauma, created the Instagram account at Asians for Mental Health. You can find that online. And you can find more of this conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from a break in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I'm glad you're listening. We are talking about mental health, particularly in the context of mental health within Asian American cultures. As we're learning from our guest psychologist, Jenny Wang, it can be rather difficult to talk about emotions and express them in appropriate ways and deal with mental health issues as they arise within Asian American cultures. She is Taiwanese American herself and wrote the book Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. You're more than welcome to join the conversation on the exchange with your perspective or your questions at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about you creating Asians for Mental Health on Instagram. You share at the end of chapter one, what fueled your journey and the creation of that site? You had some serious problems on the home front with your partner.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a time of our lives where my partner was struggling with an unknown kind of medical condition. And we were, you know, we have young kids. We were trying to, you know, live our lives. And this kind of really rocked it. And so in many ways, this social media account created a space in which I could do something that felt impactful. I could kind of talk about mental health from an Asian American lens, but also in some ways offered a mental escape from kind of those nights where we didn't have answers and we didn't know when he was going to get better. And in some ways kind of provided a haven for my own mental health as well.
You write over the course of your life, not just in that set of circumstances in that time, but of stuffing anger in particular. And what did you feel was expected of you as an Asian American woman?
I think we have, this speaks to kind of the intersectionality of my identity, right? Being a person of color, being Asian American, but then also being female. And I think as women, we are socialized not to be angry. And in many ways, we're actually invited to kind of swallow our anger for the sake of other people's comfort. And I think being Asian American, this idea that of the model minority myth that Asian Americans are super hardworking, compliant, docile even, this framing really made it hard for me to access that emotion of anger or even rage, even in times of injustice, even in times where I felt as though I was being discriminated against. And so I think that the emotion of anger is really a way that we protect ourselves psychologically when we've been harmed. And yet when we can't access that anger, sometimes that anger either gets driven inward towards resentment and rage, or it can turn towards kind of a sense of depression, right? A blaming of the self, that there's something wrong with me, and that's why I'm being mistreated.
You flat out call BS on this now, you write in the book, and you, yes, you do abbreviate it. I appreciate that. Have you become more direct, Jenny?
I have. And honestly, it is amazing to see that it is not as scary as I thought it would be. And I think when we are direct, we actually give each other the gift of understanding each other better. And I think in Asian culture, a lot of communication can feel very indirect. We might not ask for things directly from the people we love, or we might subtly suggest things when it is a deep felt need that we feel like is not being met. And so this directness helps offer us bridges between ourselves and other people where they can love you well. And it also allows us to protect ourselves when we feel as though we've been mistreated. And I now can call out that mistreatment in a more direct way versus kind of going back and wondering and questioning and doubting myself in how I experience those encounters.
We have a phone call here. I want to go to Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jenny Wang, the author of Permission to Come Home.
Hi there. I grew up with three different Asian friends, kind of like helped me understand the evolution of the concept of saving face for the family. The elementary school friend hardly said two words for 6 years of school, but we were friends and played on teams and things in the playground, but otherwise he didn't really communicate much with the other kids. And then in high school, I had a Chinese-American friend who was a little bit more verbal and wouldn't share very much information, though, and wouldn't tell me, you know, like where he lived or what his parents did. And one day I saw him going into a Chinese laundry that had the same last name as him on the window. And I went over and said hello, and he was like really embarrassed. And I said, what are you embarrassed about? He said, oh, you know, my family owns this laundry and we live upstairs. And I said, what's the big deal? I said, my father drives a truck and my mother works in a clothing factory. I don't think it's anything to be embarrassed about. In fact, your family's doing very well. They have their own business. So then he was willing to take me in and introduce me to his parents. And at first, they were very reticent to interact with me, but the second or third time I went by to say hello, they were very friendly and welcoming. And then in college, by coincidence, Jeff, at Stony Brook on Long Island, one of my college roommates was Asian American, and in those days the dorms were set up with like a living room and three bedrooms. So he wasn't my roommate, but he was what was called a suite mate. And he was very radical. I mean, he would go to all the anti-war protests, all the anti-Vietnam protests. He had one of the first really nice Nikon cameras I'd ever seen. He was at the forefront of every protest and rally. He had his picture taking pictures on the front page of Newsday newspaper, which is the big newspaper on Long Island. And I often thought about how different, you know, each one of them was progressing through our youth and young adulthood. And the concept of saving face, not shaming your family, is that still something that young people have to deal with?
You're talking about a time progression here too, Vince, and I appreciate the stories you're sharing. So over time, do the concepts that came over with the immigrants, do they lose their hold a bit?
I think that's such a great question, and thank you so much for sharing kind of those stories. I do believe that as, you know, the generations move forward in time, they may, you know, start to reduce the value placed on certain kind of cultural ideas. And so this idea of saving face may have less of a hold, perhaps, as generations move forward and as they, you know, acculturate here in Western society. At the same time, I think, you know, Asian culture and families are still very well kind of interlinked in a sense. And so this idea that we represent our families, that is still perhaps something that we carry or hold. But perhaps we see it as less of a burden now and see it as a source of pride, as a source of connection and honoring of our culture and community. And I think a lot of the stories that you shared, it speaks to some of that internalized shame or internalized sense of lesser than, you know, that idea of that we are foreign, we don't belong. And so in early immigrants, that was a narrative that, you know, we carried, and we did that with a sense of shame. And I think now future generations are really challenging that. And they're actually saying, I no longer am going to hold shame about my identity or my racial and cultural background. In fact, I'm going to see this as a gift and perhaps a superpower.
So that over time, it's also okay to talk about the things that ail you, it seems like. It's not just about, you know, keeping along the walls and not drawing attention, but, you know, when you need help to say so.
Absolutely.
So there's a particular story of your own life that just shows how different things are culturally from one generation to the next. The story of your birth and the omen that it produced and what could have happened. What tell that story, if you would.
Yes. So I only know this story since my mother has shared it with me, but I was the eldest daughter to my parents. And at the time in Taiwan, there was this practice of taking the kind of astrological date, the time of a child's birth, and bringing it to a fortune teller or astrologist. And there was a lot of kind of, I guess, trust and prominence given to these fortune tellers. And they had communicated that my birth kind of date and time kind of didn't really provide a good, I guess, omen or a fortune to my parents. That perhaps if I grew up alongside them, I might bring about misfortune to them. And this was kind of taken in such a serious light that my paternal grandmother suggested to my mother that they should give me up for adoption, or at least give me away to another family member. And my mom at the time, she was quite young, you know, she was in her mid to late 20s when she had me. And again, speaking to that hierarchy, you know, this idea of giving away your own child out of the instruction of your in-laws, that was actually common back then. And so she really had to fight back against this kind of omen, this kind of projection, and to keep and fight to keep me in the family. And it is one of those areas that I think, you know, that's the beginning of the chapter, Permission to Say No. It's where are the boundaries that define us? What allows us to push back against ridiculous or, you know, claims and requests that are made of us? And I think it really speaks to how powerful these external forces can be and how hard sometimes we have to fight to say no.
Kudos to your mother for saying no and setting a boundary and recognizing ultimately that those can be very different culture to culture. Does she feel a better fit societally here than in Taiwan?
You know, I would say that my parents, they've lived here for over 30 years now, and it's interesting to hear from them that sometimes when they go back to Taiwan, they also feel a disconnection now, even though it was their homeland. And I think in some ways, their mindsets have shifted into perhaps more a sense of openness, a sense of, you know, wanting to kind of challenge even some of the structures that they grew up with. And so in certain areas, I do believe that they have kind of found a better fit for themselves in kind of their immigrant identity as well as their American identity as well.
I want to come back to talking about anger and moving from anger to assertiveness. What's the approach?
Yes. So people often ask me, like, well, what is, like, good anger management? And I think my response often is, that we can take that anger, not diminish or disregard it, but actually understand what had prompted that anger. Because anger is actually kind of the emotion that sits on the surface. But if you really investigate further, there's often a more tender, a more painful emotion that is driving that anger. So it might be a sense of injustice, a sense of hurt, right? And that's why I'm angry. Or a sense of betrayal, and that's why I'm angry. Or a perception that I'm not valued, and that makes me angry. So often I encourage people, when you feel angry in a certain situation, can you allow yourself to sink down to that next level of emotionality that is not as kind of reactive, but is more of a tender, perhaps painful place. Because I think that's where the knowledge lives. It tells us, ooh, I've been kind of harmed in some sort of way, and that anger now exists to protect me. And so when we can sink down to that more kind of tender emotion, then it might actually offer us knowledge as to what to do or perhaps what we need to communicate to other people so that we are not put back into that place of anger again. And I often use the example of, you know, married couples, often we get angry at each other. But when we kind of sink down to that next level, maybe we feel alone in our marriage. And that's why that anger is there. Or maybe we feel as if we're being taken advantage of or not appreciated. And that's why the anger exists. And so if I can turn towards my partner and move past the anger to recognize that I feel underappreciated as a wife or a mother, and to communicate that to my partner, then they're able to reach me in a place where we can actually align and move forward towards helping me feel validated, acknowledged, and appreciated.
Well, the book certainly comes from a place of identifying issues with coping with mental health issues within Asian American cultures, but there's something for everyone in here. The book is called Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. Jenny Wang, psychologist from Houston, our guest on The Exchange and the author of the book. Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jeff.